and Joseph read the journey of the sun through the nether world with good taste and discrimination, and Potiphar was entertained and much sustained thereby. The word sustained is in place, for by the voice of the reader and the excellence of the matter to which he subdued it was sustained the sense of well-being with which the previous conversation had filled the listener. He was sustained as the flame on the stone of sacrifice is sustained by nourishment from below and fed with fresh fuel from above. It was a sense of well-being, amounting to confidence in himself or in the person of his servant, which the Hebrew slave seemed always to know how to impart to Pharaoh's friend. This twofold confidence of Potiphar in Joseph and its growth were of high importance, and for that reason it seemed good to reproduce the above conversation in detail, even though, like the confrontation in the palm garden, it is unknown to earlier versions of our story. Other such conversations there were, of course, which went to strengthen Potiphar's confidence and his preference for Joseph to an extent which finally led to his servant's exaltation. We cannot reproduce them all. It is enough to have characterized, by some striking instances, his methods of flattering his master and being helpful to him in the sense of the bond which he had made with the good Montcalm. I may use the word method without fear of chilling the reader's sympathies, since he already knows that in Joseph's way of dealing with his master there existed the same mingling of calculation and sincerity which characterized his relation to another isolated being of a far more exalted sphere. Moreover, we are entitled to doubt whether sheer sincerity, unassisted by calculation and a good technique, would ever achieve practical results, for instance, in inspiring a sense of well-being in another person. Confidence among human beings is rare, and in gentlemen of Potiphar's bodily habit, titular officials with titular wives at their sides, there is usually a fundamental, vague, jealous mistrust of everybody not constituted like themselves. So then nothing could be so calculated to rouse in them the unfamiliar and thus so much more gratifying feeling of self-respect as the discovery that a member of the enviable outer world wears the rue, so to speak. In other words, the garland in his hair, which comfortably cancels out all his other disquieting characteristics. It was method, it was calculation, that caused Joseph to let Potiphar make this discovery. But if anyone feel inclined to take offense at this, let him make use of the advantage he has in that he already knows the story we are telling. And remember that Joseph, in the hour of temptation, did not betray the confidence so engendered, but kept the faith, and was true to the pact with Montcalm which he had sworn by the head of Jacob, and incidentally also by the life of Pharaoh himself. Joseph flourishes as by a spring. So now, when he was free of his service with Potiphar, he went with a steward, whom already he called father, as his aide and apprentice about the estate, among people smiling and casting down their eyes, and learned how to oversee. Mostly there were other attendants as well, like Kamat, the scribe of the buffet, and a certain Mengpa Rey, scribe of the stables and prisons. But these were people of but average gifts, pleased to be equal to the claims of their narrow field and specialty, and to keep order among gear and accounts, men and beasts, to the steward's satisfaction. They took no thought for those wider and higher spheres which require a head for the general, nor of improving themselves to be fitted for such. They were slack creatures who preferred to write down to dictation. It would never have occurred to them that they might be born to overseeing and government, and just for that reason they certainly were not. For let a man once have the idea that God has special plans for him, which he must further by his aid, and he will pluck up his heart and strain his understanding to get the better of all things and be their master, though the sum of them be as vast as it was in the prosperous establishment of Petipre at Wese in Upper Egypt. For they were many and various. And of the twofold achievement, that Joseph became Potiphar's soothing and indispensable body servant, and that afterwards the master put all that he had into his hand, the second was incomparably the harder part. Montcalm, who initiated Joseph into the work, was right in his oft-repeated saying that he had a hard time in the world, for a man with a good head for the general There was probably too much drudgery, and Montcalm suffered with his kidneys as well. It is easy to see that he was glad of the chance to acquire a strong young assistant and to train him for his successor. Indeed, he must have been quietly looking for one for some time. Petitpré, the friend of Pharaoh, titular commandant of the palace troops and chief executioner, was a very rich man. Richer, and rich in much grander style, than Jacob at Hebron. And he always grew richer, for he was highly paid as a court official and the constant recipient of the royal largesse, and also his property bore and bred for him without stint. Indeed, it came to him only partly by inheritance, being itself, especially the landed property, a gift of the god to his favorite, and continually increased and fed from the same source. He had little acquaintance with it in any active sense, applying himself exclusively to the maintenance of his physical bulk by eating, his mental by the books he had read aloud to him, and his manly self-respect by hunting in the marshes. Everything else he left in the hands of his steward, and when the latter, as in honor bound, submitted the accounts for inspection, he would glance at them indifferently and say, "Very good, old man. I know you love me well and do your work as well as you can, and you can very well indeed. What does it say here about the wheat and spelt? Is that right? But yes, of course it is. I am convinced that you are as good as gold and devoted to me body and soul. How could it be otherwise, considering your nature and the baseness it would be to do me wrong? Out of love for me, you make my affairs your own. Very good. I leave them to you for the sake of your love. In your own affair, you will not come short out of carelessness, or worse. Besides, the hidden one would see it, and you would have only torment from it in the end. Your accounts are correct. You may take them again with my thanks. You have no longer a wife nor children. For whom should you disadvantage me? For yourself? You have not good health. Your body, indeed, is strong and hairy, but inwardly a little worm-eaten. You have often a yellow face. The tear glands under your eyes grow larger. You will probably not live to a great age. Why, then, should you offend your love to defraud me? Heartily I would that you should live to grow old, for I know not whom I could trust like you. What doth Khun Anpu, our barber surgeon, think of your health? Have his medicines helped you? I have no understanding for these things. I am healthy myself, though not so hairy. But if he does not know how to help you, and so your state grows worse, we will send you to the temple for a physician. True, you are of the servant class, and red belly should do for you in illness, yet you are dear enough to me that I would procure you a learned man from the bookhouse if your body require. Thank me not. I would do so for the sake of your love, and because your accounts are so clear and right. Here, take them again, and go on in your accustomed way." Thus Potiphar to his house steward on these occasions. For he took nothing upon himself. His aristocratic nature, its unactuality, made him shun the practical realities of life, confiding as he did in the love and care which those about him had for his sacred and fleshly person. Certainly he had good ground to trust Montcalm, for the steward really loved him, and did him loyal service, making him richer and richer with the most disinterested care and caution. But suppose it had been otherwise, and this man who had all in his hands had robbed him, so that he and his had come to want. He would have had himself to blame, and would have deserved to be reproached for his indolent over-confidingness. Yes, Potiphar presumed all too much upon the deeply motivated and tender devotion which those about him had to pay to his peculiar constitution and sacred person as courtier of the sun. We should all have had to agree to the justice of this charge. Thus, he was responsible for naught save his eating and drinking. But the hardship for Montcalm was the greater in that his own affairs were involved with those of his master. As pay for his services, he received supplies, corn, bread, beer, geese, linen, and leather, in much greater quantity than he could eat up or wear out. He had to take them to market, and exchange them for durable goods to increase his permanent holdings. The same was true in general of his master's property, both that produced on the estate and that which came from without. The fan-bearer stood high on the list of Pharaoh's beneficiaries. A rich and constant stream of rewards and superfluities flowed out upon his titular and unreal existence. The good God gave him every year quantities of gold, silver, copper, clothing, yarns, incense, wax, honey, oil, wine, vegetables, corn, and flax, birds caught by the fowlers, oxen and geese, yes, even armchairs, coffers, mirrors, wagons, entire wooden ships. All this was only in part used on the estate, and the same was true of the estate's own produce, the household goods, and the fruits of garden and field. Most of it was taken to market up or down the river, and sold in exchange for other wares, or for metal worked and unworked, which then went to swell Potiphar's treasury. And these operations, combined with the actually producing and consuming economy of the estate, necessitated much bookkeeping and careful oversight. Provisions had to be rationed out to the servants and workers. Bread, beer, and barley or lentil porridge for work days. For feast days, geese. The women's house had a separate domestic economy, which had to be supplied and accounted every day. The raw materials had to be given out to the bakers, sandal makers, paper stickers, brewers, carpet weavers, carpenters, potters, weavers, and spinners, and their finished wares to be apportioned where needed, or stored or marketed. The same was true of the crops and the produce of orchard and garden. Potiphar's livestock had to be kept up and taken care of, the horses which drew his chariot, the dogs and cats with which he hunted. The dogs were large and fierce, and he used them when he hunted in the desert. The cats were of a jaguar kind, for bird hunting in the marshes. Some head of oxen were kept on the estate, but the most of the herds were pastured on an island in the middle of the river, somewhat upstream toward Dendera and the house of Hathor, which Pharaoh had likewise given him as a mark of affection. That comprised 500 square rods of ploughland, each of which produced 20 sacks of wheat, 20 sacks of barley, and 40 baskets each of onions, garlic, melons, artichokes, and gourds. Multiply that by 500, and one can see the amount of work and account-keeping entailed. There was a separate steward for it, the overseer of the harvest and the barley, who filled the measures pressed down and running over, and measured the wheat for his lord. Actually, the man expressed himself thus in epigraphical style about his performance, yet the responsibility was not his, but Montcalm's. All the accounts went through his hands, for the sowing and reaping, the oil mills, the wine presses, the herds and flocks, in short, for all that such a prosperous estate produces and consumes, brings in, and sends out. And he had to go out on the fields, too, and see that things were going well, since he to whom they and everything else belonged, Potiphar the courtier, was not used to supervising anything or disturbing the delicate insubstantiality of his state with any care at all. So it was fortunate that Joseph, after all, did go out to the fields, at the right time, and under the right auspices, not the wrong ones. For he went not as a laborer, as Dudu, the married dwarf, in his conservatism had wanted and tried to bring about, before he had had the chance to stand before Potiphar. Instead, with tablets and pen, he accompanied Montcalm to learn the business of overseeing. Went down river with him in a sailboat with rowers to Potiphar's island. Montcalm sat stiff and solemn between the carpet hangings of his little niche, like the traveling grandees whom Joseph had seen during his first voyage. He himself, with the other scribes, sat behind. The boat was well known, and people, as it passed them, said, "There goes Montcalm, the steward of Petipre, to inspect his master's estate. But who is the strikingly pretty lad among his train?" Then they would disembark to walk over the island, inspect the sowing or reaping, have the cattle driven up, and strike terror to the heart of him who let the measure run over, while the culprit looked his astonishment at the youth to whom the overseer was showing everything, introducing it, as it were, and bowing above him as he talked. And Joseph, fully aware that the man before him might have been his slave-driver and swung the lash over him had he come out too early to the field, spoke to him privily and said, "Have a care that you do not let the measure run over to your own gain, my man, for we should see it at once, and you would be in a hole." He used an expression native to his home, not familiar here, but by that, so much the more impressive to the startled scribe of the harvest.